blame to Biden, gas prices under Biden.
The economic indicators that I've talked about are not being mentioned by this caller.
And as is the case with every single one of these callers,
who go, what do you mean the economy is doing okay?
No way, dude.
She doesn't cite any actual economic indicators that relate to the president even remotely.
Talk about GDP, talk about unemployment, talk about labor participation rate, jobs created, inflation coming down.
On and on.
The economy is not perfect.
There are many gaps.
There are many problems. They're not unique to Joe Biden.
Every time I hear this stuff, I wonder to myself,
do they at any point sit back and say, wait a second,
what the hell am I talking about?
What on earth am I talking about?
Maybe I will get informed. To some degree.
I think the answer is no.
I think the answer is no.
We have a fantastic bonus show for you today.
Hunter Biden, after being re-indicted, is now suing the IRS.
Why?
We will discuss it.
A Danish artist has been ordered to repay a museum after delivering blank canvases,
which some are saying is proof of the debasement of modern contemporary avant-garde art.
But others are saying, well, the blank canvases, the choice of shape and texture, size, it is art in a sense.
We will discuss it.
A favorite topic on the audience, I know.
And lastly, many are furious that the Senate is ditching its dress code, that Senator John Fetterman is showing up in hoodies, and if you can imagine, he wore shorts one day.
Some people like it, some people don't.
Of course, the moral majority is very much against it because it's just bad and it's not good.
What will our children think if they see a hoodie in the Senate?
All right, we will discuss that so much more
when producer Pat joins me on today's bonus show.
Don't miss it. Sign up at joinpatman.com.
We start today with the impeachment of President Joe Biden, which of course is not happening right now.
Republicans are launching an impeachment inquiry into Joe Biden.
Congresswoman Nancy Mace went on CNN last week,
was asked for evidence and said, we don't have it.
That's why we're doing the inquiry to look for the evidence.
This made no sense.
She was roundly humiliated.
Hundreds of thousands of you watched our clip on her matter
and widely thought this is a very strange way to pursue the truth by saying, we don't have evidence,
but let's investigate someone and see what we find.
Well, Nancy Mace apparently has not gotten any better talking points over the weekend.
Because she went back on TV yesterday, was interviewed on ABC,
and she still has no evidence nor any semblance of evidence.
Let's take a look at what she had to say.
This is difficult to watch.
Let me also ask you, before you go, the impeachment inquiry that McCarthy announced, even though he had said he wouldn't do it without a vote, and a few days later he does it without a vote. I want to read you something that Ken Barkley, your Republican colleagues, had to say in the Washington Post. Of the impeachment inquiry. He said impeachment is a serious matter and should have a foundation of rock solid facts. Trump's impeachment in 2019 was a disgrace to the Constitution and a disservice to Americans. The GOP's reprise in 2023 is no better. He says these allegations against the Biden family are an imagined history and a fictitious version of events. Was this premature, going all the way with an impeachment inquiry?
I don't believe that. The facts are everywhere. There are text messages, there are emails, there are witnesblowers, there are meetings, there are phone calls, there are dinners, and you can't say, hey, we're not going to follow the fire.
And the inquiry, my understanding is, as you said earlier, gives us expanded subpoena powers. I want the bank records of Joe Biden. All of that should be on the table to prove out the allegations of the SARS reports. We're talking about a significant sum of money. We are talking about bribery. And in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 4, that's the basis for impeachment.
There's no evidence of bribery.
There are witnesses in the 1023 form. There are, you know.
And you can investigate. You're on the open.
You know. It would take us an hour to go through all of the lies. You know,
there are witnesses in the 1023 form, which witnesses they can't find, who upon being found said,
I actually never spoke to Joe Biden.
The bottom line is the analogy she's using
is there are all of these examples of smoke.
And so at some point you've got to wonder,
Is there smoke because there's fire?
Except imagine that it's not really smoke, it's water vapor.
And you go, water vapor actually isn't indicative of fire.
It's water vapor.
That's what's going on here.
Now, I promise to you, and I have made this promise before, and I will make it again,
proudly and strongly.
If they find evidence against Joe Biden,
either through the fishing expedition,
even if it's through the fishing expedition,
or outside of it,
I will tell you,
Hunter Biden is now being prosecuted again.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRC Petersburg and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Any involvement of a foreign government killing a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open, democratic societies conduct themselves.
Tension is escalating between Canada and India. After Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused agents of the Indian government of assassinating a prominent Canadian Sikh leader outside a temple in British Columbia in June. We'll get the latest. Then to the case of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's close broke in the Biden administration to halt the prosecution of the imprisoned journalist. We'll speak to Gustavo Petro, president of Colombia, calling on the U.S. to free Assange, by the message of democracy,
lifting up the process. If he could pardon, have you the path to tell the world that journalists doing their jobs should not be kept prisoner,
even if it has negative impact on the interests of U.S. power.
We'll also hear from the Brazilian President Lula. And we'll speak to an Australian senator who's just flown into Washington, D.C. as part of a delegation to lobby the U.S. to abandon its plan to extradite Julian Assange from Britain.
That Indigenous leader Winona LaDuke, a judge in Minnesota, has thrown out criminal charges against her and two other water defenders
who were arrested for protesting a drug construction site of Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline.
It's been heartbreaking for us to undergo this trauma. Of all of these years of facing this corporation. And to have a judge say to criminalize us further would be a crime. That caused us all to kind of cry.
Where women want clean water. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org,
the War and Peace Report.
I'm Amy Goodman.
Authorities in Nagorno-Karabakh say they've accepted a Russian proposed ceasefire one day after Azerbaijan launched a military operation in the contested territory.
Peace talks between Azerbaijan and Armenia are scheduled to start Thursday.
Yesterday's attack reportedly killed close to 100 people and injured hundreds more.
Tensions have been growing in Nagorno-Karabakh in recent months as Azerbaijani forces sealed off its own leading to major fuel and medical shortages, as well as accusations of genocide.
Nagorno-Karabakh is overwhelmingly populated by Armenian, but is recognized as Azerbaijani territory as part of a Russia-brokered ceasefire following the 2020 war.
Protesters gathered in Armenia's capital, Yerevan, on Tuesday.
I hope that finally they can find a new solution to this problem.
A solution that can satisfy both sides,
and we can live peacefully. That's my opinion. I know it's difficult. It cannot be a decision which will satisfy both sides. We should come to that. Otherwise it will continue and hundreds of thousands of innocent people will die.
During the protests, police used stun grenades to disperse crowds trying to enter a government building. Israeli forces killed 19-year-old Palestinian Derkan al-Akhras during a raid near Jericho in the occupied West Bank earlier today. His grieving father decried his killing.
He's an unarmed citizen, a child. He has nothing to do with all this. Duran is an unarmed person. He's a civilian. Whoever walks the street should be shot because he's one of our people.
One day earlier, on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers killed another four Palestinians, including three in the occupied West Bank, and raid on the Jenin refugee camp with 20 others injured. Separately in the Gaza Strip, 25-year-old Yusuf Salam Radwan was shot dead by Israeli soldiers. On Sunday, Israel said it's keeping the Beit Hanun crossing closed as it violently cracks down on Palestinian protests. Beit Hanun is the only operational crossing for Gazans to enter Israel, including some 18,000 and Palestinians who work in Israel. This comes as President Biden's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly here in New York. The Biden administration has criticized the gutting of the judiciary by Netanyahu's far-right coalition government and its plans to expand illegal settlements, though it has not pulled back its $3.8 billion in annual military funding to Israel. The U.S. is also pushing a deal to fully normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The New York Times reports the Biden administration's in talks with Saudi Arabia over a mutual defense treaty that would resemble military pacts the U.S. has with Japan and South Korea. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is reportedly also seeking U.S. help to develop a civilian nuclear program. While campaigning for President, Biden vowed to make MBS a pariah over the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and other human rights issues. In related news, Houthi negotiators and Saudi officials wrapped up 5 days of talks in Riyadh on a possible path to ending the war in Yemen. The Saudi-led U.S.-backed conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people since 2015, with 80% of Yemen's population relying on humanitarian aid. Here in New York, world leaders continue to address the UN General Assembly. The addresses began yesterday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Russia's invasion poses a threat to all nations.
And it is clear Russia's attempt to weaponize the food shortage on the global market in exchange for recognition for some, if not all, of the captured territories. Russia is launching the food prices as weapons. The impact spans from the Atlantic coast of Africa to the Southeast Asia. And this is the threat scale.
President Biden expressed ongoing support for Ukraine and condemned Russia's naked aggression. In his speech, Biden also called for global climate action, global AI, artificial intelligence regulation, managing competition with China, and urged the UN to back a security support mission to Haiti, as he called it, where gang violence has been surging. One day after a high-profile Iran-U.S. prisoner swap, the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, told the UN General Assembly the U.S, quote, project to Americanize the world has failed, as he held a new world order. He also called on the U.S. to revive the Iran nuclear deal President Trump pulled the U.S. out of.
America should demonstrate its goodwill and genuine willingness to fulfill its commitments and conclude the path.
Outside the UN headquarters, protesters gathered to condemn Iran's crackdown on dissent and protest just after the first anniversary of the killing of Mahsa Amini. Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel called for major reforms to international economic institutions and national debts that have overwhelmingly harmed countries in the global south. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva also addressed the UN.
Continuaremos gritos. We will continue to criticize any attempt to divide the world into zones of influence and to reissue the Cold War. The UN Security Council is progressively losing its credibility. This fragility stems in particular from the actions of its permanent members who wage unauthorized wars in pursuit of territorial expansion or government change.
Lula's comments echoed calls for change to the international order at this weekend's G77 summit as low- and middle-income countries met in Havana, Cuba. Among those addressing the G77 was Honduran President Xiomara Castro.
We are not pieces in a board that promotes dependency. Our nations must not keep on suffering the massive privatization of their territories.
In Washington, D.C., House Republicans remain mired in turmoil as infighting threats by the far right push the government closer to an October 1st shutdown. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy delayed a key procedural vote Tuesday on a 30-day stopgap spending bill after opposition from members of the Freedom Caucus. Hours later, that hardline Freedom Caucus also blocked debate on the Pentagon spending bill and another blow to McCarthy. Meanwhile, House Democrats and some less extreme Republicans could work together to garner enough support for a spending bill that would bypass McCarthy and the far-right's demand for massive spending cuts. In Pennsylvania, Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro announced Tuesday, Pennsylvania will now automatically register eligible voters when they obtain or renew driver's licenses or ID cards.
We'll save taxpayers time and money and reduce the number of costly paper registrations and streamline voter registration for Pennsylvania. Look, this is common sense. You already provide proof of identity, residency, age, and citizenship at the DMV. All the information you need to register to vote.
Pennsylvania joins 23 mostly Democratic states in Washington, D.C., and have some form of automatic voter registration. Meanwhile, Democrat Lindsey Powell easily won a special election Tuesday in Pittsburgh, restoring the Democrats' one-seat majority in the Pennsylvania House. She's the first black woman to represent the predominantly white 21st district in Allegheny County. West Point's being sued over the military academy's race-based admissions policies. The lawsuit is spearheaded by the same anti-affirmative action group that sued Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The conservative Students for Fair Admissions won that landmark case before the U.S. Supreme Court in June, gutting race-conscious admissions policies at colleges and universities nationwide, but the ruling excluded military academies. And at least 20 indigenous leaders and climate activists were arrested Tuesday as actions demanding an end to fossil fuels continued during New York's Climate Week. Dozens of protesters swarmed the Bank of America Tower in Manhattan yesterday, blocking entrances as they chanted, "We need clean air, not another billionaire." The bank is one of the largest funders of oil, gas, and coal across the globe, as well as the leading financial backer of the contested Mountain Valley Pipeline. This is environmental activist John Beard of the Port Authority Community Action Network in Texas.
Killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil. is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open, and democratic societies conduct themselves.
Hardeep Singh Nijjar was a prominent leader in the Khalistan movement, a Sikh separatist movement which advocates for the formation of an independent Sikh homeland in the northwest Indian state of Punjab. India's government, which is led by the hardline Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi, had designated Nijjar as a terrorist, claiming he was the leader of the militant group. While the Indian government's denied involvement in his murder, India's long been accused of targeting Sikh leaders at home and abroad. Hardeep Singh Nijjar's son, Balraj Nijjar, spoke on Tuesday.
Now it's a matter of time for when the truth will come out. So when we heard that yesterday, it was a sense of relief that, you know, it's finally coming to the public's eyes that the Indian government is involved.
The assassination was also condemned by Bukhir Singh of the World Sikh Organization of Canada.
The persecution of fear of speaking out in the community, 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 the community,
intelligence official in Canada.
In response, India expelled a senior Canadian diplomat.
We're joined now by Arjun Singh Sethi. He is a human rights lawyer and adjunct professor at Georgetown Law. He is a member of the Sikh community. We welcome you to Democracy Now. It's great to have you with us under very terrible circumstances. Can you explain what happened in June, the assassination of Arjun Singh Sethi, and then how this all became public with the Prime Minister of Canada denouncing India and apparently having these meetings with Narendra Modi and President Biden at the G20 summit in India?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. In June, Hardeep Singh Nijjar was leaving a Gurdwara, a Sikh house of worship, when he was violently gunned down under very mysterious, suspicious circumstances. Some in the Canadian Sikh community had long suspected that the Indian government was responsible. Fast forward several months, really to this week, and we hear from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the floor of the Canadian Parliament alleging that the Indian government orchestrated the assassination of a Canadian Sikh citizen in cold blood on account of protected political speech, and so Sikhs across Canada, the United States, and the world who are engaged in protected speech are concerned.
And so are others. We've seen this administration, the Modi regime, target Muslims, Dalits, Sikhs, Christians, and so this is a warning to anyone engaged in activism, anyone engaged in speech, that you could be next.
And the Modi government has claimed now for years that Nijjar was a terrorist. Can you explain the basis of these allegations by the Modi government and what his activism was about?
Sure, so Mr. Nijjar came to Canada in the 90s. He later became a Canadian citizen, and as you know, that is a vetted process. And so clearly the Canadian government determined he wasn't a threat. And then in 2020, when the Indian government labeled him a terrorist, they did so under the UAPB, the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, which human rights bodies have routinely called draconian, regressive, and other things, because it allows the Indian government to label someone a terrorist without due process and without trial.
And so we've seen the Indian government use that law to imprison Swami, a Jesuit priest, Umar Khalid, a longtime Muslim activist, Karim Pervez, a Kashmiri journalist, and it's this same law that the Indian government used to target Mr. Niger. Again, it's draconian, and part of the outcome of this investigation process is that this law should be denounced and really abandoned by the Indian government, because again, human rights bodies have called for that for a long time.
And could you talk about some of the persecution that has been occurring under the Modi government against the minorities within India, especially of the Sikhs?
Sure. I mean, let's go back. As the chief minister of Gujarat in 2002, Modi authorized and enabled the Gujarat program, in which thousands of Muslims died. It was on account of that that he was banned from entering the United States for more than 10 years. And so he was treated as a pariah because of his role in the 2002 Gujarat program. As Prime Minister, we've seen countless human rights violations. We saw the Indian government roll back the autonomy of Kashmir and commit human rights atrocities there. We've seen India lead the world in internet blackouts. We've seen the Modi administration push forward the Citizenship Amendment Act, the National Registry of Citizens, which are mechanisms really to just strip Muslims and others of citizenship. Violence in India today, specifically targeting Muslims and Dalits, is so commonplace that sometimes it's organized online and the videos uploaded for the world to see. Just recently, in a terrible mistake, President Biden celebrated Modi with a state dinner, and the United States Congress welcomed him with a joint address. Meanwhile, hundreds of churches were burning in Manipur, and we didn't hear anything from Prime Minister Modi.
Arjun Singh Sethi, if you can talk about threats to the Sikh community worldwide, it's sort of on a model of Russians who have been poisoned in different countries outside of Russia, or Operation Condor decades ago outside of Chile, but organized by the Chilean government. Can you talk about what Sikhs face, and is this assassination unusual?
So let me go back for a second and provide a deeper context, and that context really goes back to the 1980s. In the wake of the assassination of Indira Gandhi, thousands of Sikhs were murdered in pogroms in Delhi and across India. Those Sikhs and those families are still awaiting justice decades later. And the years that followed, thousands of Sikhs were murdered across Punjab and enforcibly disappeared by the Indian government. There's a wonderful human rights organization that documents this work called NSAF in the United States, and I encourage everyone to check it out. And so Sikhs who have engaged in activism in India have long been targeted. And we've also seen that Sikhs in the diaspora who engage in activism face a variety of consequences. In some cases, Sikhs are prohibited from entering India. In some cases, the Indian government refuses to grant them visas. In some cases, their social media feeds are blocked on X and other platforms. And as you point out, we've long suspected that the Indian government has been behind targeted assassinations in other countries as well. What makes this story particularly unique is that it's the Canadian government, and it shows just how emboldened the Modi administration is. And this is what happens when the world decides to embrace an authoritarian leader like Narendra Modi. Narendra Modi should be uttered in the same breath as Putin, as Mohammed bin Salman. But when you give him a pass, When you empower and embolden him, he brings terror to a neighborhood near you. And that's what we're seeing in Canada today.
On Tuesday, World Sick Organization of Canada President Lucas Singh and the National Council of Canadian Muslim CEO Stephen Brown held the news conference at the House of Commons in Ottawa, Canada. This is Brown speaking about the threats the RSS Hindu nationalist movement poses to both the Muslim and Sikh communities.
Members of the Muslim community and the Sikh community and many other communities have been complaining for years that they have been targeted by harassment and threats by individuals and associations affiliated with the RSS. And for years, we've been talking to this topic to the community and nothing has been done. Which is why we're asking right now for the Canadian government to ban the RSS from Canada and expel its agents from the country.
And so talk about what you see happening now in Canada with this all becoming so public, of course, so is the assassination in June. But with the throwing out of the top Indian intelligence official and then India retaliating, throwing out a Canadian official, where you see this heading right now? Also extremely inconvenient for President Biden, who is trying to improve relations with Narendra Modi at this point as he sets up new alliances.
So I live in the United States. Six represent, I believe, almost 2% of the Canadian population. The Canadian government over the years has welcomed Sikhs who have been persecuted in India. And so I would absolutely defer to them. Having said that, you are seeing Sikhs protest, speak out, organize, because again, a Sikh activist who ran a plumbing business, who was a pillar of Sikh society in Vancouver, was murdered in cold blood, and so it is to be expected that they are fearful, and they want answers. The Indian government, I believe last night, summarily dismissed the claims, and Prime Minister Trudeau doubled down and asked again for the Modi administration to cooperate, and the Biden administration has said so as well. So next steps include bringing the individuals who executed Mr. Niger to account, a comprehensive investigation that documents who approved this targeted assassination, and a deeper conversation really about the fact that India is not the world's largest democracy. India is the world's largest authoritarian regime.
And in terms of the position of the Canadian Prime Minister, Trudeau has not exactly been a profile in courage in terms of differing with the United States when it comes to policy around the world. Do you expect that this strong stand of Trudeau is going to have an impact on the United States as well?
I hope so. As I already mentioned, the Biden administration has somehow taken the approach that it is sufficient to have private conversations with the Modi regime, and that somehow will nudge the Modi regime to be more respectful of human rights. But in fact, it's the opposite. When we roll the red carpet out for Prime Minister Modi, at the same time that he is perpetrating human rights atrocities, it emboldens him further. And so I do hope the Biden administration pays close attention. I do hope the Biden administration realizes that the time for private engagement is over. The world needs to come together and ask difficult questions. Of the Modi regime, a question that really should have been posed a long time ago. Again, Narendra Modi showed the world who he was a long time ago. And it's time that we listen.
Arjun Singh, thank you so much for being with us, human rights lawyer, adjunct professor at Georgetown Law School, member of the Sikh community, speaking to us from Nashville, Tennessee. Next up, we look at the growing calls for the Biden administration to drop charges against the imprisoned publisher Julian Assange. We'll hear from the Brazilian President Lula and play a clip of our exclusive interview with the Colombian President Gustavo Petro.
And we'll talk to an Australian senator who's just flown into Washington, D.C. as part of a delegation to lobby the U.S. to abandon its plan to extradite Julian Assange from Britain. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. United Nations General Assembly opened Tuesday here in New York. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was the first world leader to speak. He called for urgent action to address the climate crisis and to combat growing inequality. He also voiced support for Julian Assange, the imprisoned founder of WikiLeaks.
Preserving press freedom is essential, but journalists like Julian Assange cannot be punished for informing society in a transparent and legitimate way.
President Lula's comments come as pressures intensify on the Biden administration to drop charges against Assange. A delegation of six Australian lawmakers has just arrived in Washington, D.C. to urge the U.S. to drop its case against Assange, who is an Australian citizen. Assange faces espionage and hacking charges that could see him sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified U.S. military and diplomatic cables, including evidence of war crimes. Assange has been held in London's infamous Belmarsh prison since 2019, awaiting possible extradition to the U.S. Before that, he spent seven years living in the cramped Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had political asylum. In a moment, we'll be joined by an Australian senator who's just flown into Washington. But first, I want to turn to Colombian President Gustavo Petro. I spoke to him on Tuesday at Colombia's permanent mission here in New York, just after he addressed the U.N. General Assembly. President Lula also said at the UN General Assembly about Julian Assange, preserving press freedom is essential. A journalist like Julian Assange cannot be punished for informing society in a transparent and legitimate way. President Petro, do you think that the United States should drop charges against Julian Assange so he can be free?
I call him Julian Assange. He's a journalist. Period.
And what he did was the work of a journalist.
And he's been in prison for a long time because of his work as a journalist. It's the greatest mockery of freedom of press. And it's been brought to bear by the country that built the concept. It was in the American Revolution. What they call the founding fathers here. They're the ones who said that there must be a press independent of the powers that be. At that time, that was understood as the political power. Today, I would also talk about the economic powers because the press has succumbed to economic power interests. But if we take this foundational concept of the United States, what they're doing with Assange is contradicting, denying their own foundational principle, the very government of the United States is doing this. And so it's a contradiction in terms, it's a contradiction in itself as a society. Assange should be free, and we have called for that. I have called for that. Lula has made it into a banner. Ecuador, when the progressive president was safeguarding him, his lawyers visit us sometimes, desperate. But Biden,
Biden has several messages to put out in my opinion. I could not replace him because I don't know U.S. society in depth. And I know that he is confronting very dark backward-looking forces that date back a long time in society. Biden should take the leap of reforming the international financial system, the IMF, to reduce the debts of all countries and free up budget space for a Marshall Plan for life. He has that ability with Europe. Biden could in this way become the green leader, the environmental leader of the world. Look at all of the young people today who would like to have an opportunity to live in coming decades. And Biden could launch the message of democracy. Lifting up the process. He could pardon have you have the path to tell the world that a journalist doing their job as a journalist should not be kept prisoner, even if it has a negative interest, a negative impact on the interests of U.S. power, because it's the foundational aspect of their power. Well, the principle is that the press must operate independent of power. That would be sending a message to the world. I don't know how much it would be a message to his own society, but I believe that society itself has democratic defenses that would make it possible to recognize a great democratic leader.
That was Colombian President Gustavo Petro, where the full exclusive interview on Thursday on Democracy Now. Colombian President Petro and Brazilian President Lula's remarks supporting Julian Assange as a delegation of six Australian lawmakers have arrived in Washington, urged the Biden administration to halt this prosecution of the WikiLeaks founder, who is an Australian citizen. More than 60 members of Australia's parliament from across the political spectrum recently wrote an open letter to the Biden administration. It appeared as a full-page ad in the Washington Post. The lawmakers wrote, quote, "We are resolutely of the view that the prosecution and incarceration of the Australian citizen Julian Assange must end." The letter goes on to state, the prolonged pursuit of Mr. Assange wears away at the substantial foundation of regard and respect that Australians have for the justice system of the United States of America, unquote. Julian Assange has also received support from the highest levels of the Australian government. This is Australia's foreign minister, Penny Wong, speaking in July.
We have made clear that Mr. Assange's case has dragged on for too long, and our desire that it be brought to a conclusion, and we've said that publicly, and you would anticipate that reflects also the position we articulate in private.
We're joined now by the Australian Senator Peter Whish-Wilson. He's a member of the Australian Greens Party representing Tasmania. He co-founded the Bring Julian Assange Home Parliamentary Group nearly 5 years ago, just flew into Washington, D.C. last night. Senator, welcome to Democracy Now. If you can explain what you plan to do in Washington, D.C., and lay out what you see as Julian Assange's case.
Thanks, Amy. We've got a number of meetings with U.S. lawmakers, both in the Congress and in the Senate. We'll also be meeting with the Department of Justice, the State Department, with the Australian Consulate and Ambassador, and a number of other stakeholders, and of course doing media like I am now. The primary aim for our delegation, and it is cross-party, is to let Americans know, and particularly those in power, That Australia is still very strongly about this issue. We feel like Julian Assange has suffered enough. He's been incarcerated now in one form or another for nearly a decade. For simply publishing the truth. He is an Australian citizen. He won the highest award for journalism in Australia. A number of Australian media outlets, as well as, of course, key US media outlets. Have published articles around the WikiLeaks disclosures.
And we feel that his extradition process that's underway is a very dangerous global precedent for press freedoms. It's an extraterritorial overreach by the US government and not something you would expect from the beacon of global democracy. With all respect to your listeners, it's something you might expect from a totalitarian regime. So the recent polls in Australia have shown that 9 out of 10 Australians would like to see Julian Assange freed. They'd like to see him home for Christmas, to sit down with his lovely wife, his two children, his brother and his father, like all of us, have a Christmas lunch with his family. And we'd like to make it very clear to US lawmakers that the Australian Parliament, who we represent across political parties, also feel very strongly that if the extradition proceedings continue, and especially if he is extradited to the US, increasingly our relationship will be seen through this prism, and one of frustration. I think it's fair to say that Australia is the closest of friends and the closest of allies with the US. And of course, close friends and allies should have mutual respect. But we don't feel that the representations our government has made so far to the Biden administration have been listened to. We've certainly seen a disappointing response. From Secretary Blinken when he was in Australia recently. So we felt like we had to jump on a plane and do 60 hours of travel to be here in Washington face to face and look people in the eye and say enough is enough, Julian needs to be freed.
Well, Senator, I wanted to ask you, when you started this campaign five years ago in the parliament, you were a lone voice. There were only two of you. Now it's a quarter of the Australian parliament. Can you talk about the evolution of the leadership's view of Australia and the public's view of Australia about Julian's case?
Yeah, thank you. Look, it's a really good question. I met with Julian's father, John Shipton, nearly five years ago, and he only got two meetings with decision makers in the Australian Parliament, and I was one of them. I think it's fair to say that over the last decade, there's been a very concerted character assassination on Mr. Assange. And I think there's a very deliberate strategy here to make him unpopular. Because ultimately, an extradition proceeding, especially on espionage charges, is a political charge. And we see Julian Assange as a political prisoner. But of course, if that would require a political solution to have the extradition proceedings dropped, and if he was unpopular and people didn't like him, then no one would pay any attention. And the US government would be able to get away with this. So, five years ago, it's fair to say Julian was unpopular in Australia too. A number of people didn't want to engage on this issue. But as we've campaigned to get the facts out there around the specific details of the extradition, which relate to disclosures around the Iraq war, not to disclosures around any attempt for Julian to be sent to Sweden or anything to do with the cable gate disclosures with the US election. We wanted to just get the facts in front of people that Julian is an Australian journalist, it's a foreign journalist to your American listeners. It's the first time that the US government has tried to extradite a foreign journalist for activities on foreign soil. That's never happened before. And of course, if a democracy like the US can do this, they can bring a journalist and put them in jail for 175 years, and we don't believe they'll get a fair trial here in the US. What kind of precedent does that set for other nations? If a government doesn't like what you've published and seeks your extradition and seeks to put you in jail for silence, let's be very clear about this, to make an example of you. And I think the principles are very simple ones, and as we've put these facts in front of people, as we've had discussions across parliamentary lines, as we've talked to the Australian media, we've been able to actually put the details in front of people and they get it, they understand understand when you're doing that. So it has taken some time to build this momentum. I think the documentary about Julian's father, John Shipton, and his family, his brother Gabriel, and others there, the very personalised film about their campaign to get Julian freed, has helped humanise Julian. Because as I said, he's had a very very significant hatchet job done on his, and he's been very deeply defamed on a number of levels, and I don't believe there's any basis to truth on that. So it's actually been about changing the frame. So it's actually look at what is this specific issue of extradition and what are the global consequences if he is extradited to the US.
And speaking of changing the frame, next month your Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is planning an official state visit to the United States and will meet with President Biden. How could Assange's extradition case potentially influence our discussions in that visit?
Well, I think it's very important that our Prime Minister does raise this again with US lawmakers, especially with the President. He has raised this both privately and, of course, was raised at a press conference in Australia with your Secretary of State. And to be honest, it's one of the reasons we're here. We want to make sure as our parliamentary delegation meets with US lawmakers as we try and raise awareness of this issue amongst your listeners and other people in the United States, that our Prime Minister feels it is an important issue for them to discuss publicly. As I said earlier, this is becoming a big issue in Australia. We are the closest of friends, and while friends should be able to disagree, we see, especially in the last 18 months since the Albanese government, our Prime Minister is Anthony Albanese, the Albanese government has become increasingly closer to the US, especially in defence and security ties. The Australian government's looking at appropriating $500 billion to buy nuclear submarines from the US, for example. As we become closer to the US, we feel there should be some quid pro quo here. Given we feel so strongly that this issue of Assange's release should be the minimum we get back from the Biden government.
What has the Prime Minister expressed so far to Biden, either publicly or privately? Is he demanding his freedom for him after he was extradited to the United States to be released to Australia?
He is, similar to what you had there with Senator Wong, our foreign minister. He said he sees no purpose in the continuing incarceration or extradition of Julian Assange. He feels that enough is enough and that should come to an end. I think that's a very clear message. It is a different message to the last government, the Conservative government we had in Australia. Didn't say anything about Julian Assange. Negative about his extradition, but at the same time, they never made any public statements. So we had seen a sea change or a seismic shift in our leadership commenting on this issue, which we welcome. But we would like to see this backed up by action. Words are cheap. We would like to actually see the Prime Minister lay out to the US President and other power structures here within the US that there will be consequences if Julian Assange is extradited. We feel that's very important to be very clear as friends.
We have 10 seconds.
We have a very frank discussion.
Peter Wishwilson, I want to thank you for being with us. He has been an Australian Green Senator from Tasmania in the Australian Federal Parliament since 2012. He co-founded the Bring Julian Assange Home Parliamentary Group nearly 5 years ago. Next up, we speak with Indigenous leader Winona LaDuke. So Minnesota judges thrown out criminal charges against her and two other water defenders arrested for protesting at the construction site of Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline. Back in 30 seconds.
was Water Protectors in 2020-21 singing down to the river to pray, Great River, Minnesota. This is Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Here in New York City, protests continue Tuesday during Climate Week, and one action indigenous activist will honor the earth painted a giant mural in Times Square with the message, no green colonialism, land back now. Indigenous activists were also at Sunday's march of some 75,000 people to the United Nations, calling on President Biden to end fossil fuels. This comes as a Minnesota judge has dismissed criminal charges against three indigenous water protectors who were arrested after protesting at the construction site of Enbridge's Line 3 tar sands oil pipeline in January of 2021. The three women, Winona LaDuke, Tanya Ovid, and Dawn Goodwin, were arrested after police saw video shared on social media of them at a Rally for Rivers ceremony on the banks of the Mississippi River and treaty-ceded Anishinaabe land as they sang, danced, and prayed near construction crews. Delivered last Thursday, the Aiken County senior judge Leslie Metzen wrote, as respected members of Anishinaabe tribes, LaDuke, Ovid, and Goodwin were expressing, quote, their heartfelt belief that the waters of Minnesota need to be protected from damage that could result from the pipeline. Judge Metzen concluded, quote, in the interest of justice, the charges against these three individuals were exercising their rights to free speech and to freely express their spiritual beliefs should be dismissed. To criminalize their behavior would be a crime, the judge said. For more, we're joined by Winona LaDuke, longtime indigenous activist, author, and Anishinaabe Ojibwe enrolled member of the Mississippi Band of Anishinaabeg, who lives and works on a White Earth Indian Reservation, founded the White Earth Land Recovery Project, her first novel, Last Standing Woman, republished this year in a 25th anniversary edition. She's joining us from the White Earth Reservation, Minnesota. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm sorry I said those the names so badly. If you could say them for us.
Anishinaabe. Thanks for calling on me, and I'm glad you're not in jail.
So can we talk about the judge's decision, exactly what this means?
Well, first of all, it was so significant. I cried when I read her decision because she refers specifically to not only our religious freedom, but also our treaties because we're all members of the Mississippi Band of Anishinaabe, and our territory that we love and come from is right there. And in her decision, she says, treaties between the United States and Anishinaabe have been signed regarding these lands. This court finds that it is within the furtherance of justice to protect the defendants peacefully protesting to protect the land and water on the land addressing these treaties by dismissing this action against all defendants. So it was about our freedom of assembly, our constitutional rights, but also recognizing our treaty rights, which is what we have been saying. These are our territories, and we have a right and responsibility to protect them. And I'm so grateful to the judge, but she was clear in her decision also, saying that she just said, in the interest of justice, the phrase often and rarely applied to defendants less powerful and voiceless. For 40 years, she served on these courts, cases particularly awakened in her. She talked about the fact that growing up in Minnesota, you had a cowboy and Indian's education, and then you're supposed to adjudicate cases. So this woman took the time, 40 years of experiencing Indian people come to the bar time and time again, charged for being Indian, basically, for being Anishinaabe. She said something really profound, and she did the right thing. She brought justice, and we appreciate her.
And Winona, could you comment on how the difference between how prosecutors in Minnesota treat you and the other free speech protesters versus how the Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, who prides himself supposedly as being progressive, who was much more lenient with Enbridge, brought a single misdemeanor charge against them for breaching an aquifer, which was dismissed?
Right, and Enbridge breached four aquifers, as well. We know the crimes committed by this corporation are egregious and ongoing. They have never been charged. The one case in Clearwater County is the first aquifer breach of four. In other words, we don't know, you know, there's no more water that they're making, and Enbridge is destroying and contaminating our water on an ongoing basis. There have been no charges brought for the other three aquifer breaches, and Enbridge negotiated kind of a hush settlement, like, we'll deal with it, and then we'll, you know, we'll postpone it. Tens of thousands of people wrote to Attorney General Keith Ellison and asked him to drop the charges against people like me. I'm not a criminal. I'm a water protector. I'm an Anishinaabe woman who prayed by the river, danced, did my darndest to stop the pipeline, tried everything, and then had charges in three counties. Tens of thousands of people said drop the charges, and there are still people with felony charges that need to have their charges dropped, and Enbridge needs to be charged because they are the criminals.
Let's talk about this. Nearly 1,000 people have been arrested at protests to stop Line 3 pipeline. While many charges were dismissed or settled, about 20 are still pending. A few weeks ago, we spoke with climate activist water protector Mylène Via, whose trial for peacefully protesting Enbridge Line 3 was about to start in Minnesota. She was about to testify that day. She was found guilty of felony obstruction for her role in trying to halt construction and faces a year and a day in prison for her 2021 protest when she attached herself to a 25-foot bamboo tower erected to block a pumping station in Aiken County. Yard, who lives in Colorado, had come to Minnesota to take part in this wave of indigenous-led acts of civil disobedience to stop the pipeline. When we spoke, I asked her about her concerns as she faced convictions and sentencing.
I'm aware of the risk I was taking, and I really believe in the justice system in this court would be served. I'm fully aware that I'm risking, and I'm going. I'm going there, fully aware of the risk, but I'm not scared. I know where I stand. I know what my purpose is here. I'm grateful for you for hearing us today.
So that's water protector Mylène Via. Winona, right after we spoke, she went into court and she testified. So she was found guilty and she faces a year in prison. Can you talk about her and the other people who are still waiting? And are they all before the same judge that acquitted you?
No, they are not. They are in front of a number of judges up north. And some may also be facing jury trials. We're facing a jury trial, and this is the deep north. I was hoping that people would go with our side of the jury trial, but you don't know up here. It's pretty racist. So having said that, these people should not be charged. Enbridge is charging people with stealing time. Because they slowed down Enbridge, so they had this time theft charge. I mean, the charges were ratcheted up. They were incentivized by Enbridge paying for all of the police, $8.6 million. And some of the prosecutors were disappointed that Enbridge wouldn't pay for the prosecution, including Hubbard County, where we work and we're putting up our museum on treaty rights and culture. But having said that, it's just a shame what is going on in the North, it's a shame to Minnesota, and what it shows is the planet is facing climate chaos. And here they are justifying defending a Canadian pipeline company that imports 75% of the tar sands into the U.S. and is trying to put a pipeline across the Straits of Mackinac. They do one. Late stage indigenous behavior is bad. We need to sober up. And we need to protect the water and the human rights of people and animals and not the Canadian pipeline corporation. So, you know, I plan to speak up and help support other folks, and we're hoping that what the judge will hear will help the others because we tried everything to stop this company. And none of us want to be arrested, but I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not a criminal in Bridges.
We only have about 20 seconds, but the protesters at the UN General Assembly went to Times Square with a big mural, no green colonialism, land back now. What are you hoping to see from the Biden administration?
Well, we want the Tamarack mine stopped, as well as the mine out in Nevada. They're looking at trading our sacred Sandy Lake, where our people die by the hundreds, our sacred lake, for a Tesla mine. And we need to quit. What we need to do is reduce our consumption, get efficient, and not try to pretend that some new green colonialism is going to change things. There are many choices, like infrastructure for people, not for pipeline companies, and not for Elon Musk. And that's what we want. We want to protect the water. Thank you so much for taking a look at us in Minnesota. If it's the world's water, it's worth protecting. And certainly, we are not criminals.
Winona LaDuke, blind time indigenous activist and author who lives and works on the White Earth Indian Reservation. Founded the White Earth Land Recovery Project, her first novel, Last Standing Woman, republished in a 25th anniversary edition. I'm Amy Goodman with Wanda Salas.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heartfelt gratitude on WRCP Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
Right, no. I didn't hear them say Rasta. But just like the Marcos Garvey situation, I wouldn't let them go and take out no book. And study about the Bible. The Bible is not an instrument of Haile Selassie. The Bible don't show you the works. And the situation that Haile Selassie finds himself in, an unknown man who himself out of it. When a man tells you, Haile Selassie said, and then quote the Bible. That is some Christian mindset. We need to get the art of biography of Haile Selassie, volume one and volume two, and the selected speeches of Haile Selassie, to find out what Haile Selassie say. Because you cannot quote something that Haile Selassie say, and every time you quote something that you claim Haile Selassie say, you are quoting something from the New Testament. Then trust me, in a regional way. There's so much things to know about Haile Selassie. Haile Selassie was born Kaffraria Makonnen, 1892, on the 23rd of July, by a man named Ras Makonnen, and yet she married Ali, not known about her. Because what happened to the mother was about 2 years old. But the name Haile Selassie was given to him at birth. The name Kaffraria Makonnen was given to him by parents. But as you know, when you're into a church, they give you a name coming from the church. Like when I did born, my mother came to a Roman church and gave me a a Roman Catholic church name, you don't use the birth certificate. But I was a former figure to recognize the Rastafari movement outside of Ethiopia. When I was started to rule Ethiopia, I was about 14 years old, at least Rastafari Makonnen. And then we come Rastafari Makonnen, Ras is a title in Ethiopia. Ras, title. Tafarai man, one fear feared. That is what Tafarai means. And in that time, when Menelik defeated the Italian army at the Battle of Padua, and started to rule and get sick. They need a person to take over from him. And he designated a woman by the name of Zalito, translated to Judith. And she ruled as Empress of Ethiopia. Meanwhile, Rastafari was called king. A king of kings, king of Ethiopia. And he was the one who was doing the everyday work in Ethiopia until she died. And when she died, he was crowned Emperor Haile Selassie I, king of kings, conquering line of Judah, elect of God. This is not Rasta pronouncing these things. This is something of Ethiopian tradition. Because the Ethiopians actually believe that their emperor is descended from Solomon and a woman by the name of